Please interrupt with questions if you have them. Here's the basic picture of large scale structure, which I'm sure most people know, that the early universe model predicts some random field of small initial density perturbations at early times. We measure these while they're still small using the cosmic microwave background. But after that, the fluctuations continue to grow due to gravity. On small scales, they become large, nonlinear. Galaxies form, stars form, planets, people. On large scales, the fluctuations are still small, or close to linear. And we measure them by observing the density of galaxies or other things which trace mass. So here's a really more quantitative picture with real data that these people made. The sphere is the cosmic microwave background map, which is the furthest we can see, the microwave temperature fluctuations. The interior from WMAP, the interior is Sloan galaxies and quasars. And the real point here is there's, on any given scale, except maybe the largest scale of the sphere, there's a lot more information inside the sphere than we've probed through the CMB. There's a huge number of uncharted Fourier modes within the sphere. And that's what really I mean by large scale structures, is mapping all the structure inside the CMB. So the basic goals are to learn about the early universe or inflation or whatever by determining the statistics, inferring the statistics of the initial perturbations which grew into the structure you see. Learn about the basic contents of the universe and physical laws by studying the background evolution of the universe and the growth of perturbations, which can tell us about the contents. And there's a practical definition of large-scale structure. The key physical scale defining large is the scale of nonlinear gravitational flux. Above this scale, on larger scales, fluctuations are still small. And the key thing is they're closely related to the initial fluctuations and coupled to the background evolution. Below this scale, so small, highly nonlinear scales, the formation of dark matter halos has scrambled the initial conditions and decoupled the evolution from the background. So this is not to say there's not information there, but sort of a different nature than large scale structure. So here's an outline of the rest of the talk. First, I'm going to quantify how, to me, remarkably much large-scale structure studies are still in their infancy, despite being more than 30 years old. And I'm going to talk about a new theoretical development, how to use multiple types of galaxies to break the cosmic variance limit for redshift space distortions, which probe the dynamics of the growth of structure, which is affected by dark energy or whatever is making the universe accelerate, for example. And maybe I'll do an update of the application of this multi-tracer approach to non-Gaussian, although I probably won't have time. Then I'll talk about two surveys I'm involved in, which cover three different probes of the large-scale structure of the universe, three different observational probes. One of the surveys is the SDSS3 VOSS survey, which measures galaxies and Lyman Alpha Forest. Mostly I'll talk about the Lyman Alpha Forest, which is what I've worked on the most. And then the CHIME, which is a proposed Canadian 21 centimeter intensity mapping experiment. So the large scale structure playing field is always statistics of the density perturbations. We've pretty well measured these on large scales. WMAP has pretty well measured these on large scales. But the CMB is intrinsically limited by being two-dimensional. So you can only see this shell of the perturbations. It does show that the initial perturbations are, what makes the CMB great is that the perturbations are still small at the time redshift 1100 when we observe them. Linear theory works, but yeah. So also the CMB shows the fluctuations are nearly Gaussian. The standard statistic we start with for large-scale structures always the power spectrum, or the correlation function, the Fourier transform of the power spectrum, or the CLs, which are just the power spectrum for a spherical harmonic transform of the CMB temperature map instead of Fourier transform. There's a good reason why we always talk about the power spectrums, because the Gaussian random field is completely specified by its power spectrum. And importantly, linear evolution preserves this Gaussianity. So the standard large-scale structure probe for probing the volume, the MOS standard, probing the volume inside of the CMB, is galaxy redshift survey. Peebles and collaborators have been measuring the power spectrum of galaxy surveys since the 70s. This is an example from 1989. What we're looking at here is the position of galaxies in redshift space. So we have an angle for each of these galaxies, and then the radial coordinate is measured, is the redshift of the galaxy. This survey goes out to a redshift of 0.05, so covering about 100 co-moving megaparsecs. And now we have, much better, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. That previous 0.05 redshift would fit in this corner here. The black points here are the main million galaxy redshifts of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. They go out to about 0.2 redshift, which is somewhat limiting in that there's not that much volume in the universe out to that redshift. The red points are the Sloan luminous red galaxies. There's far fewer of them, but they go out to higher redshifts, so they probe a lot more volume. And here is a less pretty but slightly more informative Sloan survey figure. The blue is the main galaxies again. The green is the luminous red galaxies. And the red have been added here, which are galaxies that we can identify in the Sloan Digital Survey imaging and have photometric redshifts, which are inaccurate redshifts based on the colors of the galaxies. But the important thing is they probe even more volume, and there's a lot more of them than the luminous red galaxies that we can observe. And one, the galaxy component of the SDSS3 is going to be to measure redshifts for all these galaxies. So they're a proper three-dimensional survey. But remarkably, after all this time, we've actually still probed a very tiny fraction of the universe. And even BOSS will not probe a huge fraction more. So this shows the cumulative volume in the universe out to a given redshift, up to 5. The Sloan luminous red galaxies, which is the biggest galaxy redshift survey, have probed about a gigaparsec or 2. So they're really in the line here. And the Sloan Lyman Alpha Forest, which I've worked on, probes more volume, but it's very sparse, not sparse enough to call a 3D map at all at higher redshift. So there's a huge amount of information. So the number of Fourier modes we can measure is proportional to the co-moving volume. So there's a huge amount of information that's untapped out here. And it's really even more than that. So the nonlinear scale, the scale where information about the initial conditions has been erased and structure is decoupled from the background evolution, the nonlinear scale is smaller at higher redshift just because structure has had less time to grow. So there's more useful modes per volume at high redshift. And the error on a well-sampled power spectrum is proportional to 1/√ of the number of modes. So this shows the number of roughly linear modes out to a given redshift. Sloan luminous red galaxies are here. We have literally a factor of 10 to the 4 more modes to measure. And, well, so that wouldn't be any good if we didn't have ways to measure this volume and modes, but we do. So here's a plot of some future surveys as a function of redshift, and this shows d volume dz.
So the integral under the curve is the volume. BOSS is this red line, can probe the low redshift universe. And is happening, it started now, will run until 2014. Another, this 21 centimeter experiment I'll talk about, CHIME, is this black line, probes the 0.8 to 2.5 redshift range. The BOSS Lyman Alpha Forest Survey will probe higher redshifts. There's other further future surveys like the JDEM satellite, possibly, or the square kilometer array. This green line represents 3/4 of the sky. So this is an envelope on the total volume. There's another Euclid satellite that Europeans are talking about, which is similar to this JDEM ADEP concept. Probe about 100, these would probe about 100 cubic gigaparsecs. CHIME would probe about 100 cubic gigaparsecs.
What you were saying, what had been done there was too sparse. Are these results from BOSS going to?
So that's the point of BOSS, is to make it denser.
Okay.
It's SPSS3 will, so BOSS is the large scale structure component of SPSS3. There's also mapping the Milky Way component, detecting planets component. It will cover the same area of the sky, 1/4 of the sky, as the original Sloan survey. Use the same imaging. It will take spectra of more quasars and more galaxies. The quasars, the main thing, will be just higher density. The galaxies will also go to higher redshifts, so they get more volume that way. So the physics we can probe is basically anything that determines the large scale evolution of the universe and the growth of perturbations. So this is the pie chart of what we understand about the contents of the universe. We really understand 4% of it, which is atoms. There's dark matter, 22%, and then dark energy, or our stand-in for the universe is accelerating, and we're not sure why. So it's trying to get clues about these things that we don't understand, that's the goal, in addition to inferring things about the primordial perturbations, which tell us about the early universe, inflation or whatever created the perturbations. There's other things like neutrino masses, curvature of the universe, modified gravity. So the basic ways that we do this, this is the linear theory power spectrum of matter. K is the wave number. So small scales are high K. We can reconstruct the initial conditions that led to the observed structure just by measuring the amount of power as a function of scale. We can also use features in the structure, like these baryon acoustic oscillation wiggles or just the turnover scale, to measure the geometry of the universe. So this is measured in megaparsecs, but what we really measure is angles and redshifts, and the relation of those to physical distances are determined by the background cosmology. And we can also measure the dynamics of the growth of structure, the rate of growth of these perturbations, and also velocity perturbations that I'm going to discuss. This is a figure Max Tegmark made to show the scales of different probes. The CMB, since it's probing the largest scales we can see, probes large scales, that's the black points. Galaxies tend to probe intermediate scales, that's the green points. Galaxy clusters, weak lensing is the magenta. And the Lyman Alpha Forest is useful in that it probes the smallest scales of the typical observable. So I could go through the effect of lots of different physics changes on the power spectrum, but I'm just going to do one which makes a nice picture, which is the effect of massive neutrinos. So this shows the
power spectrum in a model where one of the neutrinos has a mass of 0.47 eV, which is just chosen so that omega neutrino is 0.01, divided by the power spectrum in which the neutrinos are massless. Really, you could think of this as basically the sum of neutrino masses. So on large scales, this neutrino mass has no effect on the power spectrum. As you go to smaller scales, the neutrinos are a non-negligible component of the energy density, and they're relativistic until fairly recently, and they're still fairly rapidly moving. So they free stream out of the perturbations on small scales. And not only does, so this leaves the perturbations, not only is are there do they are their fluctuations erased, but the perturbations are a little bit undermassive. So there's less gravity in the perturbations, so they grow slower through time. So the power is suppressed on small scales. And it's measuring, the point is, it's measuring this kind of feature that can tell us about the background physics and a variety of different ways of measuring the scale dependence or the evolution of the power spectrum. So recently, large-scale structure surveys have been advertised almost exclusively as baryon acoustic oscillation surveys. And I'm going to argue that this is grossly underselling the surveys, but it's important to know what BAO are because people will refer to them all the time, including me. So the place where everybody has probably seen them is the wiggles in the CMB power spectrum. The important thing about these features is there a standard ruler that we can use to measure the background evolution of the universe and study dark energy or curvature. And they're observable, so this is the CMB, but they're observable at later times in any tracer of large-scale structure where we can see the appropriate scale with sufficient precision. If you want to know more about them or the physics or see movies, you can look at Daniel Eisenstein's webpage or Martin White's webpage. The place we've detected them other than the CMB up till now is in the large-scale correlations of the Sloan luminous red galaxy, this Eisenstein et al. 2005 paper. This is the correlation function, the Fourier transform of the power spectrum. So a periodic oscillation in the power spectrum appears as a bump in a correlation function. So the scale is 100 megaparsecs. That's set by the sound horizon at recombination, which is 100 megaparsecs. So we have this standard ruler that we can observe. One important thing is you can calibrate that 100 megaparsecs from the CMB, information in the CMB alone. Then we can observe this feature at different redshifts and standard ruler. So what we will measure is the feature's angular scale, or it in the transverse directions, or its velocity redshift scale in the radial direction. And if we know the feature scale, which I've represented by S here, the ruler length, we can infer the angular diameter distance, the relation between distance and angle as a function of redshift, or the Hubble expansion parameter as a function of redshift from the radial direction. And those are sensitive to the background cosmology. So now I'm going to talk, though, about how to use large-scale structure beyond the BAO-only approach, which is what people have been talking about mostly lately. This BAO-only approach looks at the scale of these little wiggles in the mass power spectrum and treats everything else here as noise. But there's a huge amount of information in the rest of the measurements that these redshift surveys aimed at BAO will contain. And I would say that there's no compelling reason to think only about BAO, because we understand large-scale clustering at least as well as most other probes of cosmology like supernova and clusters, and I would argue better. And here is the problem, or the fear that people have, is of what we call galaxy bias, the fact that galaxies don't perfectly trace mass. And I would argue, and have argued in these papers, which are kind of technical and not what I'm going to talk about primarily, that this bias problem is not quite the sort of intractable monster that it's made out to be, that we just haven't thought carefully enough about it. And the key physical principle is that the complexities of galaxy formation that we're not interested in are local, or at least short range, relative to the scale of the large scale observations that we want to use to measure more fundamental physics. Partially because we just look at large enough scales. We look at scales where this is true. And as often happens in physics, from a large scale point of view, if we're only interested in large scales, these small scale complexities can be bundled into a few free parameters, the bias parameters, which we call bias parameters. And that's what these papers talk about this in more detail. But all we'll need for this talk is the very asymptotic large scale limit, where we think that the relation between galaxies and mass follows linear bias, meaning the galaxy density is at where delta G is the galaxy overdensity, I stands for the type of galaxy, meaning could be different colors of galaxies or different luminosities of galaxies, whatever, just different populations of galaxies, are related to mass fluctuations, delta M, on large scales by some bias factor, which is a constant but might depend on the type of galaxy, plus maybe some noise, where this locality of the galaxy formation process means that this noise should be white, uncorrelated on the scales we're looking at. And in this model, the galaxy power spectrum is just proportional to this bias factor squared times the mass power spectrum plus some noise power. And the standard approximation for this noise power is that it's 1/n of galaxies, which is fairly important for what I'm going to talk about. So there's a lot of evidence that this is true, and it really has been the model that we've been using for a long time. So now I'm going to.
Seems like a very radical thing to say that
galaxy
formation is not a, for example, a threshold process.
But that's local. That's the key thing that we talk about in these papers, which is if you assume that the galaxy density is a local function of mass density, you can do a Taylor series. Expand the galaxy density. You don't know that function, but you expand in the density fluctuations, delta mass. The coefficients of that Taylor series become the bias parameters. And then you get into technical details related to the fact.
Assuming it's analytic, and you can't expand it in the Taylor series. It's not a smooth function.
Yes.
So.
And
what if it's not a smooth function?
I mean, it's some very, it may be some very complex filter for primordial linear density field. Now, locality is locality, really.
This is something, I mean, so there is more work to be done. to establish this, but I mean, we have no evidence that this relation is not analytic when you look at it from the point of view of the relation between large scale galaxy and mass fluctuations. This is.
Well, I guess one picture, I'm not saying I'm not advocating this, but one possibility is you stimulate a galaxy forming locally and then actually this propagates downwards.
It has to have a way to propagate. That's the...
Radiation.
So there certainly is one loophole in this, which is the propagation, one clear loophole, which is the propagation of radiation during reionization. Mm-hmm. So that's the one time when the effects of local galaxy formation really clearly propagate to large scales. Mm-hmm. We don't have any evidence that that's a big effect. And every model that you find that people make of it say that it should not be a big effect. It is the one thing that, you know, if you read these papers, I would say, if it's important at a given level of precision, then the whole large, on a certain scale, the whole precision large scale structure cosmology program on that scale is probably due. So you found your way to an important issue, but we don't have, right now, we don't have any evidence that that's true. It's something to think about.
On the next transparency, I think you mentioned it's working well in simulations. In those simulations, though, you're not taking this into account. Is that right?
Well, it works even in simulations that do take it into account, okay. because we don't expect the effect of that propagation of radiation during reionization to be important for relatively large galaxies. It's more likely to be important for very small galaxies. So what I really meant by works well in simulations, is the noise power. This is definitely, this is a guess that people or something made a long time ago as to what the noise power level should be, assuming that the galaxies are a Poisson sampling of the density field. And one of my arguments is, in detail investigation of this model, is that guess is just a guess. This noise level in general could be different than this. And that's important in what I'm going to talk about, which is going to be talking about what we can do with future surveys that go into the low noise regime, so high sampling density.
Another question on that last slide. How many values would this index I take in practice?
In general, as many components as you want to break your survey up into, each one can have a different bias.
But the more you put in, the more free parameters there are. So.
Sure. Yes.
In practice, so, matter.
You have to do things that work even in that aren't sensitive to that. I mean, so you still can measure the scale dependence of the power on large scales, even if you have this uncertainty in the normalization. And you'll still be able to measure the redshift space distortions that I'm going to talk about. Getting around this parameter, and yes, the fact that not only can you not predict it for one population of galaxies, you can split the population into groups, and they have different biases, and you can't predict those either. These are figuring out what you can do in spite of that is the kind of the goal of large scale structure phenomenological theory.
So if this relation is true, then objects of different classes should have identical correlations up to a scale, overall scale. So you should be able to make a graph of dwarf galaxies, bigger galaxies, clusters of galaxies. They should all be precisely proportional.
Yeah.
Now, isn't there a contradiction already? Because when you go to clusters of galaxies, the correlation function is positive out to about 50 or 100 megaparsecs, whereas the galaxy correlation function isn't.
I could do a whole talk on this, and I was thinking that I'm supposed to give a talk at Waterloo, and I was thinking that the talk would be on that. So
no problem.
It's demonstrably false. I mean, certainly, There, so when I'm, what I'm talking about is, I argue that it should be true in the genuine large scale limit, as k goes to zero. Now, as k, as you go to finite k, you go to increasing k, you expect deviations from it. That comes from the higher terms in the Taylor series. Mm-hmm. And in general, you can put in higher derivative terms.
Just go back and show us where they are in your expansion. Where are the higher derivatives?
I don't think I didn't write down.
You didn't fill them in there.
And in general, what the paper, I just posted a paper a couple days ago, which generalizes this to include dependence on the tidal tensor, the local tidal tensor, and also the local velocity shear field, which not only, so the goal is working towards putting in every possible term, sort of in the field theory, motivated by field theory thinking, more consistent with symmetries and locality, although then higher derivative terms to model local, it's near local deviations from locality.
Yeah.
And so now, so in general, those you can't make any argument that there couldn't be local dependence on the tidal tensor. Mm. And Lagrangian, if you make a Lagrangian bias model, you actually predict this is so this is implicitly an Eulerian model, meaning that you're writing the galaxy density's dependence on the local mass density at the time of the observation. The Lagrangian bias picture is to assume that the initial density field specifies, you can identify where galaxies or halos will form in the initial density field, and then so you make a model of the galaxy density as a function of initial density perturbations, and then the gravitational evolution will move them and change. And that actually predicts some dependence on the tidal tensor. And part of the goal of this is to sort of unify those pictures into, because we don't have any fundamental reason to believe that Eulerian local bias is correct, or Lagrangian local bias. If we've included, but in order to do robust precision cosmology, precision fundamental physics cosmology, we need to include all possibilities and think about the asymptotic large scales, and then the deviations from that as you go into so I'm talking about what I'm implicitly talking about is perturbative deviations. So there's very large scales. I think you can compellingly argue, except for the reionization thing, that which is still finite range, but that range can be pretty long. That linear bias should work. Then as you, there should be a regime where perturbative bias will work, where there's more parameters than these, but there's still a finite number. Then there's a nonlinear regime where you're done. But the understand there's where I'm did I so there's a huge amount of information. Because the universe is three-dimensional, the number of modes up to a certain k goes like k cubed. So there's a huge amount of information in that highest k range that you can model effectively. So a different talk would be all about that. This one, though, is supposed to be about a simple picture on larger scales than that. And I'm not even saying really that you wouldn't try to push this picture or this redshift space distortion thing into those higher k regimes, but we haven't worked out exactly how to do that yet. I mean, that's the program of precision cosmology, those 10 to the 4, how to deal with those 10 to the 4 modes, factor of 10 to the 4 modes that we can measure but haven't yet, how to actually use all that information, that's the program. Okay, well,
now I'm going to talk about this idea for how to use redshift space distortions, which are, so when we do this galaxy or any kind of redshift survey, we measure spectral features and they give us the radial coordinate, and that would be a perfect coordinate, a perfect distance if everything was expanding with the Hubble flow, but there's peculiar velocities, deviations of local deviations from the Hubble flow. And these make redshift an imperfect measure of distance. So a measured correlation function or power spectrum appears to be anisotropic. And here's an example of a measured galaxy correlation function. This pi is the radial coordinate, and for some assumed cosmological model, that we're not dealing with the geometric effects, at least in this part of the talk. The transverse direction is, well, this is the transverse direction. The contours or colors are contours of constant correlation function. On small scales, small separations, and particularly along the zero transverse direction, there's this elongation, which comes from random small scale motions within halos. This is what is sometimes called the fingers of God effect. This generally, when doing precision cosmology, we would in one way or another be trying to cut this region out, this tube around the zero transverse direction. On larger scales though, there's this squashing of the contours, which come from linear peculiar velocities, which are just the velocities which are the motion which is creating the density fluctuations in the first place. And these are, and they're not a nuisance at all. They're an opportunity to learn about the velocity field and the dynamics of growth of structure. So that's what I'm going to talk about now, which is how to use multiple tracers of density with different bias. That means these different eyes, different galaxy types, which surprisingly, in this case, are your friend. It's good that you can measure different types of galaxies with different biases to beat the cosmic variance limit on redshift space distortions. And this is in this paper. The bottom line is you can get order of magnitude improvements in measurements of the rate of growth of structure, the DDA, with similar improvements on dark energy constraints and more, where this D, so in linear theory, the density perturbations at some time are just proportional to the initial density perturbations times this growth factor. And in a typical lambda CDM model, this is scale dependent. But if you did have a model where it was scale dependent, it wouldn't change any of the story. You would just measure it as a function of scale. So how these peculiar velocities and redshift space distortions work is here. This black line is supposed to be a mass density Fourier mode. The red line, or just a sine wave, of mass density. The red line is the associated peculiar velocities. They're out of phase because, as you'd expect from gravity, velocities are just such that stuff's falling into the peak in the density and falling out of the underdensity. And there's a simple formula for how these velocities relate to the mass density perturbations. The key quantity here, as we'll see, is this F, which is d log d, d log a, which in a typical lambda CDM type model is proportional to the matter density at that redshift to the 0.6. This is actually the only part of this slide that depends on anything other than linearity and the continuity equation. So the only thing that's required for this picture to work is basically that the velocities you're seeing on large scales are the ones that led to the formation of structure. And this shows what the redshift space distortions, the redshift space distorted density field, which leads to that distorted correlation function. So the redshift space coordinate, the line of sight coordinate, which is indicated by these parallel lines, is the true position plus some velocity, delta velocity. So we're always talking about differences between positions of two objects out in the survey. It's not so important how far away they are from us, normalized by the Hubble parameter. And if you just do the Jacobian factor of this
coordinate transformation, you can calculate the stretch of space density is this real space density, the bias times the mass density, plus this x, whoa.
It's not your laptop. April, please.
Plus you have this divergence along the line of sight of the radial velocity, which is what creates the distortion. So here the black is the density, mass density mode. The red is the change in density caused by this redshift space distortion. So the velocities are out of phase, which means stuff's falling in here and out of the void, which is constructed with the density field itself. You get extra, an enhancement of the density contrast. So the green now, these are supposed to be the mass quantities. The green is the biased density field for some type of galaxy. It's just arbitrary bias of two, which is not completely arbitrary, because, for example, that's roughly the bias of the luminous red galaxies. And then blue is the further enhanced redshift space distortion, redshift space distorted Fourier mode, where I'm assuming this is a radial Fourier mode. And in Fourier space, this is the redshift space distortion, distorted Fourier mode is the real space Fourier mode times this bias plus this f, this d log a factor, times mu squared, where mu is the cosine of the angle between your line of sight and the Fourier mode. So the modes along your line of sight are distorted, transverse modes are not. And the traditional approach to exploiting these redshift space distortions is to just measure a power spectrum, to think you're going to measure a power spectrum of one type of galaxy or an aggregate set of galaxies, and then try to infer this growth rate that you're interested in from the angle dependence of this power spectrum, by marginalizing over this bias factor that you don't care about. And you can do that, but it works. You lose a remarkable amount of information by doing that. So the general error on a power spectrum for a noise-free Fourier mode per Fourier mode is the variance is just one. The fractional variance is one. If you have to marginalize over this bias factor in a measurement of the redshift space power spectrum, your measurement of this velocity divergence power spectrum, which is this f factor squared times the mass power, so bias free now, is you lose the factor you lose depends on this amount of redshift space distortion. This beta, which should be defined here, is just f divided by the bias. So beta of 0.5 is a typical value. You lose genuinely a factor of 65 in the variance per Fourier mode. So it's equivalent to taking your survey and making it 1/65th of its volume, which is remarkably bad. And the goal is to get some of this information back by the goal of this multiple tracers idea, two different galaxy types, is to get some of this information back for the same volume. So if there's no noise, the basic idea is to think of taking the ratio of redshift space densities of two types of galaxies. The top line here is the bias of type 2 plus its redshift space distortion factor times the mass density, real space mass density perturbation, divided by the other one, which has a different bias. The key thing here is that these
the random field, which is this, the density perturbation, cancels when you take this ratio. If the bias relation is noise free, and that's, of course, it's not going to be noise free, but I'll get to that later. So you have some quantity here, which can has mu is this cosine of the angle, the Fourier mode, the angle between the Fourier mode and your line of sight, which isn't a random variable. It's you know this exactly in its zero noise limit. Alpha here is the ratio of the biases of the two galaxies. Beta is this f d log d d log a over the one of the biases. So you can think, I'll look at a transverse Fourier mode, so mu is zero, and I can get alpha exactly. And then I look at a second radial Fourier mode, and I know alpha, so I can infer, I can calculate beta from that. And so with only two modes, if there's noise free, you can measure this beta factor precisely. In this, with small noise, the error scales like the noise over the power. So beta actually still has bias in it, which is not, so it's not something you really want for fundamental physics. But you can go back to the original bias formula and see that if you know beta perfectly, so you have divide this by f. If you know beta perfectly, you will know the f times the mass density perturbation perfectly. And that gives you the velocity divergence power spectrum. So in the zero noise limit, you've completely eliminated this factor of 65 noise that comes from marginalized or degradation of your signal that comes from marginalizing over the bias factor. And the reason that this is possible is that these two different biases of the different types of galaxies have allowed you to distinguish the different modulations or different weightings of the redshift space relative to the real space part of the field. So they've allowed you to distinguish these. So of course, real surveys have noise. This is the thing that the naive estimate is just that the power is 1 over the number density of the galaxies, or the RMS fluctuation is 1 over the square root of the number density, assuming it's a Poisson fluctuation. That tells you if you get an infinite density of galaxies, you can go to zero noise. That probably isn't true, but nobody has ever really demonstrated where it fails. It works well. And one of the future things will be to figure out what happens as you go to high number density of galaxies. But this shows, assuming you can get to different signal to noises, how well this technique will work. So this shows the fractional error on the divergence, velocity divergence power spectrum as a function of redshift. The points, this is for different bins of 0.2 extent in redshift. That's the points, the lines of the errors. Green is what you would get from a single tracer. So just this traditional way of doing this kind of thing. And these are actually zero noise single tracers, where you have this big loss from marginalizing over the bias, and even in the zero noise limit, this is what you get. As you increase the signal to noise, you have multiple tracers, one with a bias of 1 and one with a bias of 2, you have the black lines. So they're signal to noise of 1, which is the way that typical baryon acoustic oscillation surveys are designed. And then 3, 10, 30, 100. And red is your new cosmic variance limit, which is equivalent to if you were able to see velocity divergence directly with no bias. So you've gained a factor of roughly 10 in your ability to measure this velocity divergence, which is telling you about the growth rate of structure, the dynamics of the gravitational dynamics.
Is to get that cosmic variance
then? Well, this is the infinite density. This is infinite density of galaxies.
Is accurate measurement?
No, because what you get is a perfect measurement of beta. Uh-huh. But that only gives
That then gives you a measurement of velocity divergence, which is as good as you would get if you could see the velocity divergence directly. But that still has the usual, you know, power spectrum error per mode is 1. But 1 is a whole lot better than 65, is the point. You've multiplied the volume of your survey by 65, or that 65 can vary between 200 and 25, depending on exactly what the biases are and what omega is and what redshift is. But for the luminous red galaxies, it would actually be 200, because they have high bias.
So you cannot directly measure F after this? You don't
get F at any given, you get the velocity divergence power, so you get F of Z times the mass power. Mm-hmm. So if you think about that, that has a F of Z squared. What you're really getting is dD dA as a function of redshift up to 1 overall normalization factor, which is the overall amplitude of the power spectrum. And you also get scale dependence of the growth if you or of that if the model has it. So you can use, I'm out of time pretty much. You can use this to constrain dark energy or whatever is making the universe accelerate. And this shows this dark energy task force figure of merit, which just arbitrarily have some way of comparing surveys and sort of saying, We're measuring the acceleration better. The Dark Energy Task Force first defined that we're going to talk about W of A, this dark energy pressure over density, being a linear function of the expansion factor A with two parameters, W0 and WA. And then they said, well, let's define a figure of merit for surveys, which is the area inverse of the area of the 95% confidence contra as a survey can obtain on these parameters. So that bigger, better, more precise survey, smaller error bars gives a bigger figure of merit. And no one has really shown that you can do anything that talking about specific dark energy models or specific or even modified gravity models really can give you a different relationship between surveys than this. So it's useful to quantify the value of surveys. So this shows if you have a three-quarter sky survey, which is the kind of survey we'll be talking about doing in the next decade, out to some maximum redshift, the increase in figure of merit over the case where you have the Planck CMB satellite plus the Dark Energy Task Force Stage 2 experiments, which means the presently happening lensing supernova cluster experiments. So having Planck plus that stuff is 1 on this plot. If you just treat these galaxy redshift survey as a variant acoustic oscillation survey, just use that Weigel distance scale, you get this blue line. So that kind of saturates at about a factor of 10 improvement in this figure of merit. The green is if you add these redshift space distortions. So even without this multi-tracer trick, you do a lot better than what is with these redshift surveys, and it's generally advertised for as if you think of them only as GAO. And then your ability to constrain this dark energy or whatever gets better and better as you can go to higher and higher density galaxies. It's pretty clear, so this is black is increasing signal to noise from 1, 3, 10, 30, 100, and then infinite. It's pretty clear that we could get to 10 or 30, the Sloan main galaxies, which are these million galaxies at low redshift, which don't probe that much value, probably would be in that range. It's not clear where this Poisson noise approximation will start to break and limit this kind of thing. And I will just cut to the end.
Somebody has died.
So the main points were we have huge amount of information left out there. We can use it to probe more fundamental physics than just galaxy formation if we can understand and and theoretically understand the large scale clustering. This redshift space distortion technique will make these surveys a lot more powerful. And then what I didn't talk about is that I'm involved in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey BOSS Large Scale Structure Survey, which has a galaxy component and a Lyman alpha component at higher redshift. And also, there's a proposal for a 21 centimeter intensity mapping experiment, which is just an efficient way to map a lot of this volume. So this would be a 100 cubic gigaparsec survey by 2013, which is, so remember the current surveys are the Sloan Digital Sky Survey Moon Mystery Galaxies is 1 to 2 cubic gigaparsecs. So we could very quickly, this is a remarkable idea, I think, due to Whaley Penn at CETA, could very quickly actually achieve these high levels of precision.
That's a relatively low redshift. I mean, you're not talking about before reionization or anything.
The telescope.
2 or something.
0.8 to 2.5 it's limited by the 400 megahertz to 800 megahertz. Mm-hmm. Although you start to be degraded, it's 100 by 100 square telescope. And that doesn't give you enough resolution to really resolve the VAO scale or more generally the nonlinear scale as you go above redshift. Mm-hmm. At 2.5, its resolution is like 25 parsecs.
So it's really targeting the very large scales then. I mean, if that's
that's close to at redshift at the low redshift then 0.8, it's 7 megaparsecs, which is as much as you want if all you want is large scale structure linear or near linear. It loses as you go to higher redshift. If it works, we'll build a bigger one. it's a great idea. There's possibly foreground issues which. It's not guaranteed to work. But if it works, it could do the JDEM kind of $1 billion survey for $10 million-ish.
This is like an antenna or a telescope?
It's a telescope. It's square, 100 meters by 100 meters. It's actually 500 meter by 15-ish meter half cylinders that just sit on the ground. They don't point or anything. The transverse direction, the Earth rotates, which gives you scanning in one direction. The way these radio telescopes work, you have receivers along the cylinders, you FFT the signal along that direction, and that you can compose beams which point, which map a substantial fraction of the sky in all at the same time in that cylinder direction. So it just sits there, and in 2 years, and as high of signal to noise from just basic system temperature point of view, to map all the neutral density, all the neutral gas in this patch of in all the sky I can see from the ground in this redshift range set by the frequency, as well as you can.
The other one, SKA, is it similar or?
So what's brilliant about this idea is the previous ideas for using 21 centimeter and radio telescopes was to require you to image individual galaxies and get your redshift kind of like you would with a normal redshift survey. And the telescope, that's just really hard. And that's why SKA might be able to do it in 2024 kind of time scale. But this just, because you say, I don't care about individual galaxies, because when I do large-scale structure, I'm just looking at density modes, the average density on large scales anyway. I'll just have this relatively low-resolution telescope, which gives you the sum of all the neutral gas in that region, which will trace large-scale structure just like anything else.
Are there some indications of the foregrounds already?
Well, we know there's big foregrounds, mm-hmm. orders of magnitude higher than the signal. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that they're like galactic synchrotron, which is very smooth in frequency. Yeah. Where what we're looking for is the structure frequency.
So ideally, you will be able to fit out that smooth component.
And if not, you move to Western Australia?
Not to get away from galactic.
It's not going to help the foregrounds.
Not the galactic ones. I was thinking of the terrestrial.
They are. The galactic ones. It's the killer. Yeah.
Bye, lads. Okay, let's back.